From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. The Food and Drug Administration's vaccine advisory panel meets tomorrow and could clear the way for Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine to be authorized for emergency use. FDA analysis shows the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is safe and effective, and if it's approved, it would increase the vaccine supply, hopefully allowing more people to be vaccinated. Dr. Lena Wen is a professor of public health at George Washington University and an emergency room physician, and she joins us now via Skype. Dr. Wen, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Glad to join you. Thank you.
You're a volunteer in the J&J vaccine trial. Tell us, what is the timeline here for authorization and then distribution?
Well, hopefully all of this is going to happen very quickly because the data that were released by the FDA yesterday look extremely promising. So the hope is that the FDA advisory committee is going to be meeting tomorrow, will recommend to the FDA to authorize the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The CDC committees will then meet. And after that, the distribution will occur, which could occur, I think, as soon as next week.
So the J&J vaccine is just one shot, unlike the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines, which are both two shots. What is the efficacy rate, doctor, of the J&J vaccine compared to the others?
Well, it depends on the numbers that we look at. And here I want to point us to the numbers that really matter, because I think people have gotten fixated on the initial number. They look at the number that's reported of 72% effective in the U.S., for Johnson & Johnson versus 95 for Pfizer and Moderna and say, well, that vaccine doesn't look as good. But actually, we need to be looking at the numbers that really matter. The endpoints that matter are preventing severe disease. And in this regard, the Johnson & Johnson is 85% effective at preventing severe disease and actually 100% effective at preventing such severe disease that it causes hospitalization and death. Something else that really matters for Johnson & Johnson is that one of the three clinical sites is South Africa. And the predominant form of the variant at the time that this trial was done in South Africa is this B1351 variant,
yes.
The one that maybe the other vaccines, we don't know how effective they are towards it. And even in South Africa, there were no cases of hospitalizations or deaths.
So having another vaccine available, this J&J vaccine, do you think that that will speed up vaccination efforts in this country? Because I think a lot of people would agree they're slower and much more complicated than they should be.
That's right. Supply is the limiting factor. And so having one more vaccine that's authorized, especially one that's available as one dose rather than two doses, certainly will help. Although I think a lot more needs to be done to increase supply at this point.
Let me ask you about guidelines for people post-vaccination. Tell us why fully vaccinated people still need to wear masks and still need to stay socially distanced from others.
What we know about these vaccines is that they are so highly effective at preventing you from getting severely ill, which is so critical. What we don't fully know yet is the degree to which it prevents you from being a carrier of coronavirus who could still be infecting others. Now, there's growing evidence that probably getting the vaccine also reduces your viral load, your ability to infect others, but we don't know exactly how much yet. What I would say, though, is that we really need clear guidelines on this because it's not right to tell people that they have to do exactly the same thing post-vaccination as they did before. I do think that people post-vaccination should feel pretty comfortable doing any essential activity, going to their doctor, getting their cancer screenings. They should get that done. They shouldn't go bar hopping, but I think that fully vaccinated people can probably also safely see one another, including indoors without their masks on, as long as there's nobody else who lives in their household. Mm. If they are going to be visiting others, for example, grandparents wanting to visit grandkids, they should wear masks during travel, try to reduce their other risk as much as possible so that they don't end up infecting their other family members.
Right, because there are some people who might not think it's important to get the vaccine if it doesn't allow them to fully return to normal life right away, I guess.
That's exactly right. I think we need to be clear about the freedoms that you gain after getting the vaccine. Yes, you're protected against severe disease, which is so important, but I think we also need to let people know that vaccines are the way for us to regain normality in our own lives, as well as to eventually restore normality in the country.
Dr. Lena Wen is a professor of public health at George Washington University and an emergency room physician. Dr. Wen, thank you for your voice during this pandemic and for being here today.
Thank you.
Now to Nashville, where there are still questions about Anthony Warner, the man behind last year's Christmas morning bombing. The blast in downtown Nashville injured several people, damaged dozens of businesses, and disrupted 911 service in multiple states. Warner was the only person to die in the explosion, and it's not clear why police never searched his property when it was reported that he was building bombs in 2019. Samantha Max of member station WPLN reports.
On August 21, 2019, attorney Raymond Throckmorton called 911. He said a client in South Nashville was threatening to take her life.
She has also given me information about another resident of that part of Nashville who is, I think, also got some mental and emotional problems, who is allegedly building bombs in his house.
After interviewing the woman and sending paramedics to her home, police went to the man's house, where they saw several security cameras and an RV parked behind a wooden fence. According to a police report, officers knocked on Anthony Warner's door multiple times, but he never opened it. The report was passed along to the bomb squad. The FBI also searched the man's name in their databases without luck. Police Chief John Drake says investigating further would have violated the man's rights.
The RV was inside of a backyard, and it has an expectation of privacy. And so without any type of search warrant, I mean, it was even fenced in. You couldn't even have a dog that could accidentally, you know, wander over there. You'd have to have a reason to get inside.
In order to search someone's private property without their permission, police need to prove they have something called probable cause. And the legal barrier is low. Officials just need to prove that they're likely to find evidence that a crime is being committed. So why didn't the Metro Nashville Police Department even try to get a search warrant in 2019? Drake says officers couldn't smell any chemicals from outside the RV and couldn't see anything suspicious inside it. But former federal prosecutor Steve Miller says police had more than enough evidence for a warrant.
There is zero legal consequence for trying to obtain a search warrant. If it's granted, a judge has granted it, and it will overwhelmingly be upheld by the courts later on. If it's denied, it's been denied, and no one's rights have been violated.
Miller prosecuted multiple bomb cases while working for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, and he says Nashville's police department missed several critical steps in its investigation that could have helped them get a warrant. Miller says officers could have reached out to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to check their databases for any purchases of bomb-making materials. He says they also could have followed up with the man's girlfriend and other people who knew him, rather than trying to interview the suspect himself.
If I was conducting the investigation, that's the last thing I would do. I mean, maybe at the tail end of the investigation, but what's he going to do? Say, yeah, I'm a bomb builder and I'm planning to blow up downtown Nashville? That's not likely to happen.
Ultimately, Miller says a judge could have weighed various factors when deciding whether or not to grant the warrant, including the complainant's mental health and the seriousness of the threat. He calls bomb-making a five-alarm crime that requires all the expertise at the department's disposal. Former public defender Keita Haynes says police often searched her clients' homes for lesser charges on much less information.
I had black men, and their charges are gun charges or drug charges. And just the amount of police work that goes into arresting people, getting search warrants for people on anonymous tips. There was an anonymous tip for a client of mine that he was selling drugs. And so they did a knock and talk, but it was not the same knock and talk that they said that they did over at Mr. Warner's house, where they knocked a couple of times and then they left because he didn't answer the door.
Haynes says officers would often bang on her black clients' doors and refuse to leave, conduct surveillance on the street for days, or search through the trash to find incriminating evidence. But that didn't happen for a middle-aged white man. As a defense attorney, Haynes says her priority will always be to protect people's constitutional rights. But she says there seems to be a double standard, depending on who police are investigating and what they're being investigated for. She thinks the department needs to look deeper than just the missteps in this particular case.
But if they're not dealing with the root cause of the problem, which is systemic racism, again, that runs rampant through this police department, if they are not dealing with that, if we are not calling it for what it is and forcing them to deal with this, to me, that's the issue. And that's what we need to be calling for Metro to deal with.
Chief Drake has denied that implicit bias played a role in how the Metro Nashville Police Department investigated the case. A multi-agency after-action review committee is investigating the department's response to see if police made any mistakes. For Here and Now, I'm Samantha Max.
April 30th will be President Biden's 100th day in office, and before that day arrives, he wants most K-8 schools open. Right now, about a third of all schools are closed for in-person instruction, but our next guest says we can reopen them safely with precautions like masking and social distancing. Dr. Benjamin Linus is an associate professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, but his first job is parent. He joins us on Skype. Doctor, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And why don't we start with that first job? What has this been like for you as dad in this pandemic? How's your family dealing now with a year at this point of remote learning?
Yeah, thank goodness. My family's doing relatively well, all things considered. I'm fortunate to have a good job and the privilege of having stability in my life. And generally, I feel like my kids are largely doing okay. But during the COVID pandemic, it hasn't always been clear to me. I've had these fears of, wait a minute, what if my kids are actually being damaged? Like, they haven't been in school now full time, at least. And I think generally as a parent, largely felt that we have our hands on the reins and you're never in full control of your life, but that we were largely in control of the situation. And now suddenly it's not at all clear.
Right. And so that's what motivated you, I presume, to write the article in Vox with the headline, I am an epidemiologist and a father, and here's why I'm losing patience with our teachers' unions. Make the case, then, for why schools should reopen now and what the research tells us.
So there's been the data has been coming out since last summer. And right, the timeline has been that it started out with observations of schools opening in other countries and seeming to have things under control. We also began to do studies in looking at people who tested for COVID and were positive, and people who tested for COVID and were negative, children, I should say, excuse me, students. And what emerged from those studies was that dining out in public, things like playdates and birthday parties, emerged as a risk factor for having a positive COVID test. Being an in-person school did not. And what we've seen from a couple of important studies is that actually you don't see a lot of transmission in the building. So the first was a study from North Carolina that came out in the journal Pediatrics. This was a large study. It was more than 77,000 students and 18,000 staff. What that study found was that while the community rate of COVID was about 100 to 200 cases per 100,000 people throughout the study, so what the CDC would define as the red zone, there were 773 cases in the community, but only 32 cases of secondary transmission in the schools. If secondary transmission were as common as in the school as it had been in the community, they would have expected to see 800 to 900 cases in the buildings, but they only saw 32.
So you're making the point that the evidence is becoming clear. Now, the unions say it is not. I spoke recently with Becky Pringle. She's the president of the National Education Association. And when I asked her about some of the research that's coming out on schools reopening, she says for the most part it's not being done in the poorer neighborhoods. And she said that the CDC even acknowledged that to her. Let's listen.
One of the areas that we're most concerned about are very densely populated urban areas where we know we have issues of equity and access. We know that this pandemic has disproportionately impacted Black and brown and indigenous communities. We already know that. And all of the crises it's spawned, the economic crisis, the healthcare crisis, and they are also more likely, Peter, to go to those buildings that have been crumbling.
So how would you respond to that? And the larger point that teachers say they don't feel safe working in these older buildings with poor ventilation and that there just isn't room for social distancing. Do they have a point?
I absolutely acknowledge that and think they have a point. If you were in a situation where you were 3,000 children in a building designed for 1,000 kids before COVID, then it's likely not possible to get back into that building with 3-foot social distancing and masking without some improvements or some extra space. And if our answer to this is, well, the buildings aren't safe, therefore we shouldn't go back in, those disparities are going to get sewn into the fabric of our society for a generation.
So what do? Get the kids back into the schools now and then invest, or wait?
I think we need to be doing both at the same time, and we need to be creative about getting kids back into those most difficult situations carefully and likely slowly. But I don't think that we should wait for everything to be in place before we start bringing those kids back, because those are the kids that are hurting the most in this epidemic.
Well, another one of the big issues here is vaccinations. I understand that you agree with the CDC that says all teachers need not be vaccinated to reopen schools, and that it's going to be tough to hear if you're a teacher who's older or someone who has a pre-existing condition. What's your argument?
I think the simplest argument for that is, if you look at the data that we mentioned before, none of those teachers was vaccinated because the studies happened before the vaccine. So we have empirical evidence that it is possible to operate a school without COVID vaccine and not have a lot of COVID in the building. But that's a different question than, should teachers be vaccinated, which I absolutely think that they should. But I would also say that we shouldn't wait for all the teachers to be vaccinated before we start.
So take your doctor hat off for just a moment and put the dad hat back on.
Yeah.
How great is your fear that when the fall rolls around, that your kids will still be home?
I have some concern about that. I'm trying to remain optimistic. So I really think that it's important that we start doing the work this spring, because it just feels like magical thinking to think we can go from where we are right now to full in-person learning on the first day of school without having an intermediate period where we're getting used to it and building up.
Dr. Benjamin Linus, infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and a dad, father of 3. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
When to vaccinate teachers is part of a larger debate on how to distribute doses. Stephen Thrasher has written about what he sees as ethical failures in that distribution system. He's a journalism professor at Northwestern. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And from your perspective, what are the big ethical questions that we are failing to confront when it comes to distribution of these vaccines?
The biggest ethical problem, which is also a logistical problem, is that the United States is not going to people to give them the vaccine. They're waiting for 330 million people to fight amongst themselves to find it. And that's happening very differently in 58 different states and territories. And it's really pitting people against each other. There's an idea that it's equally accessible when they open up available vaccines through a website or such. And that's actually not equal at all, because the people who are most needing these vaccines are often elderly, incarcerated, perhaps disabled, living in congregate settings, or not able to understand English. So to just kind of say, sign up on a website and find it, is actually a huge disadvantage to the people who need it most. And there's not enough active attempts to go out to and find and deliver the vaccines to people who need them.
I think this point that you're making here is so important to talk more about. You write that when the government wants to, it is quite capable of coming to us. Think of your taxes or the draft, for instance. But it's going to make the people do the work, in this case, as you're describing, to go to the government to get the vaccine. So why do you think that is?
It's a function of how neoliberalism works, to off-put onto people work and effort and resources to figure things out themselves. For instance, in California, New York, very large states which have large tax bases, you know, you could, in theory, increase taxes and hire, you know, a couple thousand people to be scheduling this stuff. And instead, it's cheaper to just say, we'll put up a website and they can schedule it themselves. Some of it is a deeper issue where in this country, we do conceive of freedom as being the government doesn't know where you are. But to do something like this, the onus is put back on the people. And the government can kind of say, oh, people are being irresponsible. Rates are going up because people aren't getting their vaccines, when it's not the people's fault at all, who are all scrambling to try to get them. It'd be very different if they said, you're going to get a vaccine on this date 3 months from now. Here's $2,000. Stay in your house until then and ride it out.
Right. So I was going to ask you, what would a system that works in just the opposite way look like to you, with the government coming to us?
It would look like, a centralized process that's not just happening county by county and state by state, but happening sort of at the federal level. It could be the United States Postal Service mailing people postcards saying, you're going to get your vaccine on this date, show up on this date to get it. But concurrent with that, which is very important, is that we have to give people resources to manage until then. So people need material support to be able to stay at home, that we should be giving people the money to be able to stay at home. And then the other thing is that the government should be going through sites and locations. West Virginia did very well with this. They forewent a program with CVS and Walgreens, and on their own and through community drugstores, they went to nursing homes and they vaccinated their entire nursing home population faster than anyone else. So the government could also be going to work sites and taking vaccine to them rather than waiting for everyone to go to the government.
There is a reason, of course, why all of this matters. You use a map of Chicago to illustrate this point. On the one side, it shows who is dying of COVID-19. And then on the other side, it's showing the same map that demonstrates who's getting vaccinated against the disease. And the colors on the map are totally inverse. I mean, what's the message there?
It's a real problem. The people who have the most access to getting the vaccine are the people who've been least affected by it so far. So in a city like Chicago, where I live, people on the north side have largely had access to one of the most powerful forms of prophylaxis we know that works. They've been able to work from home. There are also people who have a lot more control over their time and a lot more computer literacy and fluency. And so they can, you know, get onto a website, maybe do it at 5 a.m. if they want to. And then on the south side, you have the people who have not had that form of prophylaxis. They've had to go to work in person. And so their rates are much higher. And if you're a shift worker at Popeyes or at an Amazon distribution center and you're working from midnight to 8 a.m., you're going to be the least likely person to be able to say, yes, I can get online and find where to get a vaccine and get it at 3 in the afternoon.
Stephen Thrasher, will link you to his piece for Scientific American at hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it? And then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email.
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
The Black Lives Matter Foundation announced today that it will provide small grants to Black people hurt economically by the pandemic. The foundation said the grants would be $1,000 each. It's part of the foundation's new survival fund amid the wait for more relief from the federal government. Let's learn more about this from MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Ali, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Tell us how these grants work and who could get the money.
Well, they're fairly basic. Anybody who wants to apply for it can submit an application. It's reviewed by a selection committee that determine whether the applicant meets the eligibility requirements. And if you're approved, the money gets directed directly into your bank account or made available on a prepaid debit card. No strings attached. It's currently open to all Black people who are experiencing economic hardship. There is going to be special consideration for members of the trans community, to single parents and guardians of children, and the formerly incarcerated. So they're really trying to get this to people who are sort of outside the system or otherwise have difficulty accessing other money that's available.
And how is Black Lives Matter funding this program?
It's being administered through an organization called Up Together, which is part of something called the Family Independence Initiative. They are sort of an anti-poverty group. They're working to disrupt the cycle of poverty. The way they like to do it is direct investment to low-income families and to budding entrepreneurs. So it's part of their mission. Black Lives Matter has partnered with them.
Mm. Ali, last week you visited Birmingham, where more than 70% of residents are Black, and you spoke with people about the impacts of the pandemic there. Here's Hernando Carter, an internal medicine physician in Birmingham.
Unfortunately, the pandemic is a manifestation of what we've always seen. You know, there have always been disparities and inequities in healthcare. It's been said that, you know, if America gets a cold, then the Black community gets the flu or pneumonia.
Allie, what are you learning about how the disparities there are playing out in Birmingham?
Well, there's three different things. I mean, Birmingham is a place that used to be an industrial town. Now it's a medical town. So healthcare is the biggest industry there. But the disparities about Black people getting access or quality access to healthcare still exist. So going into coronavirus, that still existed. Like most other places in America, Black people affected more seriously by coronavirus, higher mortality rates, and yet lower rates of testing, and now the same thing, lower rates of being vaccinated. And on top of that, there's skepticism, as there is in many communities, but there's particular skepticism in the Black community about the vaccine. So a lot of challenges getting people to get tested, getting people to get vaccinated, and then getting people to accept the idea that they want to be vaccinated. The story of Birmingham is not all that different from most sort of cities in America, Black majority or not.
Mm. And about 30 seconds here, Ali. Broadly speaking, what is the goal of the program?
It's really the idea is a lot of people have been thinking about if you're trying to address poverty, what happens, what doesn't work is the trickle-down system where, you know, the government tries to sort of spread money around. Getting money into the hands of entrepreneurs and people who need the money results in a better return on investment. It's a philosophy, and that's what they're trying to employ here. Mm-hmm.
That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. As always, Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is apologizing for delays in mail delivery over the holidays.
Too many Americans were left waiting for weeks for important deliveries of mail and packages. This is unacceptable, and I apologize to those customers who felt the impact of our delays.
DeJoy made his remarks in a congressional hearing yesterday where he told lawmakers the money-losing postal service is in a death spiral unless serious reforms are made. Joining us now is Washington Post business reporter Jacob Bogage. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In some context here, during the Trump administration, DeJoy was accused of politicizing the postal service and making delivery changes in the middle of an election season that depended on voting by mail. But yesterday, he told lawmakers that he's been working on a 10-year strategy to turn the post office around. What did that involve?
We're starting to hear some details about it. He told a group of mailing industry officials publicly that that would include raising prices. Normally, the price of postage is tied to inflation. That's why the price of a stamp is only 55 cents. This current price increase would divorce the price of postage from inflation, and that could be significant. And then the other thing we're hearing is that the mail's going to slow down some more. Folks briefed on his plan say that the Postal Service will no longer transport first-class mail on airplanes, which basically eliminates a two-day service standard for certain types of mail. So at minimum, Things are going to take 3 days from get to point A to point B, and that's really going to burden the entire system.
More bad news there. What's at the heart of these problems?
Well, the Postal Service faces an existential crisis that there's no real easy answer to, which is that we're sending 20 billion fewer first-class mail items than we did 10 years ago. The Postal Service has to go 6 days a week to 161 million delivery addresses. It's hard to just make the finances of that work.
And just briefly, late yesterday, President Biden appointed three new members to the Postal Board, which has the power to fire the Postmaster General. What do those changes, do you think, mean for DeJoy's time at the USPS?
You know, it's hard to say. Louis DeJoy yesterday said he was in this for the long haul, and I think this is another vestige of the Trump era, that the Postal Service is a traditionally depoliticized entity, and now we're talking about how many Democrats and how many Republicans are on the Board of Governors. And, you know, when you hear the name Louis DeJoy, you know, it's immediately followed by the qualifier Republican mega donor. It's hard to say what his future is going to be, but one of the biggest obstacles that stands in his way is the continued politicization as a remnant of the Trump era of the nation's mail.
Jacob Bogage covers the U.S. Post Office for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been taking the time to hear about some of the 500,000 people here in the United States whose lives were lost to COVID-19. In a few minutes, we'll learn about the life of Ivan Forbus, a Vietnam veteran who had been living in a long-term care facility in Ohio. and died of COVID-19 complications just a few days before Christmas. But first, we hear from Maurice Ojuang Jr. from New York City.
My dad was named Maurice Ojuang Sr., and unfortunately, he died due to COVID-19 on April the 21st, 2020. He was a man who loved God. He loved his family. He finished top of his class in Kenya, and he eventually migrated to the United States, where he literally had to start from scratch with nothing and nobody aiding him, and basically work his way up through school, got his computer science bachelor's degree and master's degree in that, eventually earned a doctorate. There are some memories that I hold close, near and dear to my heart. One that jumps out at me is when I was much younger and he sought to teach me the concept of percentages in mathematics. And for whatever reason, I could not grasp the whole idea of what percentages meant. So after a long night of reading and yelling at the top of his lungs, and the concept is still not being ingrained in my mind, he told me to get up and to do jumping jacks, 100 of them, I think. And he made me repeat, percent means out of 100, percent means out of 100. And over 15 years later, I still remember that. That has to be one of my favorite memories of him teaching me and being involved in my schoolwork in its entirety. He definitely was passionate about everyone receiving education, particularly a Christian education. He also went back to Kenya and built a school in his home village with my mother. And I think that's his greatest lasting legacy that I hope to keep alive, that I know he would want me to keep going.
Joy, 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 there be joy by and by. Joy, 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 where the joys never die.
There is a favorite song of his. It's actually a hymn entitled, Oh, There'll Be Joy. And it speaks about a time when God's children will leave this earthly planet and go to heaven to rest and no longer have to work. And I thought about that song actually after he died, and I said, I guess the next thing he will get to experience is that joy, because his work here on earth is done. A man that many people miss, not just myself, and a man that I thank God for blessing my life with.
I'm Mary Lee Bendig, and I live in Groveport, Ohio. Ivan Jerry Forbes. My brother was 78 years old, and he liked to go by Ivan. He was named after my father, and he loved Kenny Rogers. He loved country and Western music, and his song that kind of a summation of my brother's life is The Gambler. I don't know if you know the words to it, but it just kind of says there's no guarantees in life, and that we have to kind of take the good with the bad. And every gambler knows that everything's about surviving. And he was a survivor. You know, you got to know when to throw away things, and you know what to keep.
Knowing what to keep, because every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser.
That you can hope for is to die in your sleep. And my brother, he did. He passed away peacefully on the 22nd of December. But it was written during a time after he came back from Vietnam. He went to Vietnam, the Marine Corps, right after he got out of high school in 1961. And he was there until 1965. And my brother came home a little different than when he went in the service, and it kind of mellowed him out. He wasn't the same person, and he became a little bit introverted with especially the Vietnam vets that returned home. They didn't get the recognition that they should have, and it was hard. It was a burden for them to bear, and they fought for their country, and they should have gotten that recognition. But to think that there's over 500,000 deaths that now have occurred with COVID have surpassed the Korean, the Second World War, the Vietnam War. It's just horrendous figures. And what hurts the most is that you're not able in many of these situations to go in, to be with them, to see them, to put your hand on them, to comfort them. So if this little snippet of broadcast that I've made would help anybody know that there are other people that have gone through this and have lost loved ones like this, that it is just so important to know that there's someone that has some empathy for them. And we're right there with you, and our hearts are right there with you, and our prayers.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
That was Mary Lee Bendig of Groveport, Ohio, remembering her brother, Ivan Forbus, who died of COVID-19 in December. Before that, we heard from Maurice Ojuang Jr. of New York City, remembering his dad, Maurice Ojuang Sr., who died of COVID-19 last April. Quick note to our vegan and vegetarian friends. We're going to be talking about meat in this next segment. Meat lovers, this one is for you. And we're not talking about burgers and steaks or chops. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst has three recipes for cuts of meat that might not be as well known. Hi, Kathy. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here.
Well, so what cuts of meat are we cooking today?
Well, we're going to talk about a cut of beef, lamb, and pork. You know, we've been in this pandemic for a full year, and it's still winter in many places. So craving that comfort food is still very much front forward. And the first cut we're going to talk about is a cut of beef. It is called a boneless beef chuck roast. It also goes by the name boneless shoulder pot roast or center cut chuck roast. Very rich flavor. Cut from the shoulder. It is best braised and made like a pot roast. It loves long, slow cooking. And here we have braised it with leeks and celery and garlic and shallots and red wine until it is just fork tender.
So long and slow, right? I mean, tell us why braising is so important for these specific cuts of meat.
They really, most all of them have a layer of fat, which scares a lot of people, but fat is flavor. And in this case, you want it to slowly be released so that it keeps the meat moist, but gives you a beautiful, tender piece of meat at the end. Unlike a roast or a burger or a steak, which is cooked quickly, you sear it, you cook it up, and it's done. We're talking an hour and a half, 2 hours, that point where your kitchen just smells so good, you can't wait.
Yes. All right, that's a beef chuck roast. Tell us about the lamb shanks.
Lamb shanks have become really popular. This used to be a very inexpensive cut of meat. It is still among the least expensive cuts of lamb. And in most restaurants, you'll be served an entire lamb shank. I often like to ask the butcher or whoever I buy it from at a grocery store to cut it in half or thirds. Lamb shanks also have a thin layer of fat on the outside. You want to cook them long and slow till the meat falls off the bone. They're actually loaded with iron and magnesium and omega fatty 3 acids, all good stuff. And I cook these with parsnips and carrots and leeks. And one thing that's worth mentioning, these meats tend to be monochromatic, right? You've got this brown meat, maybe you've got the orange from the carrot, a white from a parsnip. But what I like to do with the lamb shanks is serve them with something called gremolata, which is a very simple mixture of chopped fresh parsley, grated orange and lemon peel. And not only does it add a brightness to the stew, but it adds this beautiful color that kind of breaks up that winter monotony.
Mm. Can you use any pot, Kathy, or is a crock pot the best tool in the kitchen?
I don't actually use a crock pot. I have a big cast iron pot. Whatever you like to make soup in, the heavier the pot, the better, because in general, you want to sear these meats first in a little bit of oil, and then they're slow cooked with the vegetables in either some stock or wine.
Okay, I want to get to the pork belly. Tell us about that one.
Me too. Pork belly is very popular in Asian cuisine. You can find it in Asian food markets. More and more, you'll find it in grocery stores, and you should ask for it. It comes from the underbelly. It is not bacon. It's boneless. It's uncured and unsmoked, and bacon is generally cured and smoked. The key to pork belly is that it has a huge layer of fat on it. And so what happens is that that fat protects the meat underneath it, and it becomes absurdly tender.
Yes.
This is a wonderful recipe from a woman named Fuchsia Dunlap, where the pork is cooked twice. It's simmered with fresh ginger and scallion. Then it's left to cool, and then you slice it and stir fry it in a wok or skillet with garlic and chili bean paste.
Oh, my
perfect
goodness.
Winter food.
When
yeah.
you say twice cooked, what do you mean twice cooked?
So first you simmer it with the ginger and the scallion and let it cool. And what you're doing then is you're rendering some of that fat. It gets rid of it and it starts to tenderize the pork belly. Then it cools and you thinly slice it and quick stir fry so that it gets crispy and you add all these wonderful aromatics.
Oh, about 30 seconds left. I wish we had another hour. What other cuts of meat should people keep an eye out for right now?
Oh boy, there's so many. Lamb shoulder is a favorite of mine.
Oh, yes.
Very fatty, very good slow cooked. Beef shank, like lamb shank, can
okay.
be inexpensive and cooked the same way. And then skirt steak or flat iron steaks tend to be a bit less expensive. Also really wonderful flavor. And mash some potatoes or sweet potatoes and celery root.
Stop.
You got a meal.
Stop.
It's lunchtime.
It is. And I'm turning now to my turkey sandwich. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst will look for all your recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you. Delicious as always.
Thank you, Jane.
Peter, I know what I'm cooking this weekend.
Oh, me too. You know what I love about Kathy Gunst? She always challenges me personally. That conversation about lamb shanks, I never would have thought
yes.
to do it, but I'm into it
well,
now.
Well, and the pork belly. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.